This is the Berkeley Signal.
Oh no, here he comes.
And then look at him.
Are you fellows rapping? I can do that Reggie, or reggae type of thing, you know.
One, well, actually, two, we were just leaving.
Trump, Trump, take out the cash in on me, Trump. Trump, Trump, check out the cash in on me. I'm on Donald Trump, me tell him I ain't heard about me. I'm in last wife, Ivana, come and cash me money. She want out, she want this, she want me in up front. And some of the this, we say, dog, it's like the cat, hear me. Hold up your hand if you love the money. Hold up your hand if you love it, give me. Gun pan beside me, I be kill somebody, see. Because the money in me truck, they want me come get see.
I'm a house that we shelter.
it's showtime.
Well, how did you like that, then?
Well, we really must be leaving.
Yes, yes, Donald. It was smashing to see you again.
I picked up in the property I've got down in the Caribbean.
Oh, yes. I remember it.
Why don't you stick around, and I'll grab some more for you.
Oh, no, I'm really glad. I think I...
Hey, Cash, how much longer I gotta wait for my money?
God made this land for all of us. Greedy people like you want to hog it to yourself and your family. And
me and my family?
Yeah.
Cassius, I'm your f***ing uncle.
I just really need a job.
40 on 2.
This is telemarketing.
Stick to the script.
Hey, hello. Mr. Davison, Cassius Green here. Sorry to bother.
Let me give you a tip. You want to make some money here? Use your white voice.
My white voice?
I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. Thank this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regalview.
As always, we'll be getting that out to you right away.
You're doing so good with the voice thing.
Holla, 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 holla!
Yeah. Oh, yeah! All right!
You're going upstairs, power caller.
They even have their own elevator.
Sorry to Bother You premiered this year at the Sundance Film Festival. The film's stars include Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, Arnie Hammer, Terry Crews, and Danny Glover. The film received rave reviews and is being hailed as one of the best movies of the summer.
Well, for more, we're joined in studio by Boots Riley. He's the writer. He's the director of the critically acclaimed film Sorry to Bother You. Poet, rapper, songwriter, producer, screenwriter, humorist, political organizer, community activist, lecturer, public speaker, best known as the lead vocalist of The Coup and Street Sweeper Social Club. Author of Boots Riley, Tell Homeland Security, We Are the Bomb. Sorry to Bother You is Boots Riley's first feature film. Boots, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And with this astounding accomplishment. Describe it for us.
This is an absurdist dark comedy with magical realism and science fiction inspired by the world of telemarketing. In it, Lakeith Stanfield plays Cassius Green, a black telemarketer with self-esteem issues and existential angst, who discovers a magical way to make his voice sound like it's overdubbed by a white actor. That white actor is played by David Cross. Hilarity ensues.
And why telemarketing?
I actually did telemarketing a couple times. One time in school while I was actually going to film school. And then another time after our second album, I had kind of a 24-year-old midlife crisis where I decided I had been an artist too long and I quit. And me and some friends created an organization called the Young Comrades. And I needed money to do that. And I was good at sales. So I did telemarketing.
So you talked about the white voice. I want to turn to a clip from Sorry to Bother You. Cassius Green, played by Lakeith Stanfield, has just started his job as a telemarketer when an older employee, played by none other than your friend Danny Glover, gives him some advice.
Hey, young blood, let me give you a tip. Use your white voice.
Man, I ain't got no white voice.
Oh, come on, you know what I mean. If you have a white voice in there, you can use it. It's like being pulled over by the police.
Oh, no, I just use my regular voice when that happens. I just say, back the fuck up off the car and don't nobody get hurt.
All right, man, I'm just trying to give you some game. You want to make some money here? Then read the script with a white voice.
When people say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. I'm talking about the real deal. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer, this is Langston from Regalview. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
And for people who are listening on the radio, that was actually Danny Glover who's voicing that.
Yeah.
So talk about the white voice and what that means, Boots.
Well, so in the film, Danny Glover's character Langston, actually, it's an edited piece that we just played. But in the full piece, he explains that the white voice doesn't really exist. White people don't even have it. They use it, and it's a performance. There's a performance of whiteness that is all about saying that everything is okay, you've got your bills paid, and, you know, this kind of smooth and easy thing. And it's, at the very least, the idea of what black folks have to do in order to hide their identity sometime over the phone or to say that they're safe. It's like the opposite of the racist black trope that are out there that say, okay, black folks and people of color are savage or somehow their culture is insufficient, and that's why they're poor. These racist tropes of people of color have a utility because we live in a system that necessitates poverty. It must have a certain number of unemployed people to exist. But the explanation is that it's nothing to do with the economic system. It's everything to do with poor people. And these racist tropes come. So the white voice is almost a reaction to that. And there's all sorts of levels in there, too. What's also left out is, just so people know, the full line is, I'm not talking about Will Smith white. That's not white. That's just proper.
And then as Cassius masters the white voice, he rockets up the chain to success. And then the conflict begins with his girlfriend.
I don't know. There's conflict all through the movie. Yeah. I don't know when it begins.
Yeah.
But definitely. Tessa Thompson plays, her name is Detroit. Her character's name is Detroit, who's an artist in the Bay Area that is also trying to use her art to expose a lot of the injustices. And kind of what this film deals with, her character is probably the closest to me, you know, and deals with the questions of what art can actually do, if anything.
So expand on that. And Tessa Thompson, her job in life is dancing with signs in front of stores.
Well, I don't think her character would say that's her job in life. That's how she gets some money to pay the bills. But she's a sign twirler, and she for money. But she's a gallery artist and also part of agitprop arts group that does things somewhat clandestinely. Her character and the character played by Steven Yeun have somewhat of a conflict and an alliance because Steven Yeun plays a union organizer.
And that goes to the issue of what's happening, where they work at Regal View. I want to turn back to the film, sorry to bother you, when Cassius Green is promoted to be a power caller at the telemarketing company where he works in Oakland. Well, things take a dark turn.
I got promoted.
I'm a power caller.
What do they sell?
They're not selling, but we're selling.
No, well, there's no amount of money that'll make me do that.
Here's the starting salary. Well, man, I'm going to have to get me some new suits.
Whatever I wear, no, I'm here to be clear.
It is morally emaciated.
I can't ride with you.
I'm doing something I'm really good at.
Cash, I'm going to make you a proposal. I can see that you want to say no, but I wouldn't do that before you see what I'm offering you. Cash, you are awesome.
Sorry to bother you. That's part of the trailer. Boots Riley, so he is pushed upstairs as the people at Regal View, the evil telemarketing firm, are starting to organize. You have this big Norma Rae moment in the film. But talk about that. And we're talking about this just today, Amazon Prime Day, there are people who are protesting where? In Poland and Spain. In Germany to protest working conditions at Amazon workplaces. And interestingly, this morning, I don't know if you did this deliberately, but you were on CBS this morning. That was deliberate. But they tweeted out their schedule for the morning. And so you retweeted it because right there at the end, It says Boots Riley discusses. Sorry to bother you. But right before it, they were discussing Amazon's best Prime Day.
Yeah. And of course, I didn't pay attention to that till afterward. But yeah, it's I didn't do that on purpose. But I will say what is happening on purpose is the confluence of what's being talked about in this film and the movements that are growing. And am I wrong to say that the protests are taking the place of taking the form of work stoppages?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that's put forward in my film as a tool that we need to use. I believe that since the beginning of the new left, progressives and radicals have turned more to spectacle and gone away from actually organizing at the actual point of contradiction in capitalism, which is the exploitation of labor, which is also where the working class has its power. And we've gone in favor of demonstrations that don't necessarily have teeth, but they show where our head is at. And I feel like we have to give these demonstrations more teeth by being able to affect the bottom line and say, you know, say you can make no money today or you can make less money and give us what we want.
Now, you set the film in Oakland, obviously, where you grew up, and the importance of Oakland, because it's always been a hotbed of radical politics and radical organizing, how you feature the city in the film.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Could you rephrase the question?
Yeah. Why you decided so much to feature Oakland in the film? And
oh, you know, I think that's just a great byproduct of wanting to make a good film. And, you know, I come from Oakland, so I'm going to write about what I know. And I believe my ways of storytelling or making art have a lot to do with the details that make people up. And those are the details that surround us. And then I also just happen to, you know, living in a place, you have great ideas of what you want to shoot. I also know so many people in Oakland and the Bay Area that we could get some of the locations for free. So it's just all of my art has to do with where I am. And so, which is one reason, like, I never moved to L.A. or New York, because it's just part of what makes me.
Boots, we've been doing a lot this year on the 50th anniversary of all the various events of 1968, like Juan deeply involved with the Columbia student strike in April of 1968. So you have Danny Glover. He is teaching young blood a few things at the telemarketing firm, another telemarketer in your film. But he was one of those 50 years ago protesting at San Francisco State, as was your dad.
Yeah, yeah. And that's
about that history.
So Danny Glover and my father, Walter Riley, met at San Francisco State agitating and organizing the San Francisco, being organizers of the San Francisco State strike, not the organizers, but some of them. And so that, you know, that strike created the first ethnic studies program, now school, in the United States. And, you know, so we didn't get it because people passed the right, they did pass the right measures, but they were forced to. And so it's a great, 360
using
spiral.
Something other than the white voice to get what they wanted.
Yes, exactly. You know, maybe someone did use that along the way, but they had the backup of shutting down the school in order to force the hand.
If you could talk about the company, you've Regal View, this is the evil telemarketer, and then you've got Worry Free. Talk about Worry Free and then go on to talk about labor struggles.
It's interesting because, in the film, there's a company called Worry Free that guarantees you housing and employment for life. And they house their workers in the same place. One way they save money is they house their workers in the same places that they produce whatever they produce. And so it's a lifetime contract. So to all extents and purposes, it's slavery. But what's weird is I don't know if that company is illegal right now. It'd be an interesting research topic to see if the company Worry Free that's in Sorry to Bother You is actually legal. However, what I'm a little scared of is that then somebody will try it, you know?
Today is the fourth anniversary of the police killing of Eric Garner. And the New York Police Department that killed Eric Garner is issuing an ultimatum to the Justice Department saying this is way too long to decide whether you're bringing federal charges against their own officers, like Daniel Pantaleo, who put Eric Garner in a chokehold, strangled him to death. Your thoughts. This is an issue, police brutality, that you have taken on for many, many years.
Just personally, I still help out campaigns against police brutality. I'm a little personally burnt out on them because I don't know where we can go with it, you know? Like, what happens when after you get a whole community to spend a year of their lives coming together, you know, in sometimes in great numbers to get an officer fired, and then they get transferred to some other department and get pats on the back I don't know. This is not some well thought out thing, but I just know, like, I feel like campaigns against police brutality may become more effective once other parts of our movement also grow, and where, as I say, we have some leverage. Like, for instance, maybe in Mike Brown killing, if radicals and progressives had been organizing labor, and what I mean, I don't mean the existing labor organizations, that's fine, but I'm talking about the rest of the working class, the 93% that's not organized. If we had a way to say, okay, we're shutting down the city, we're going on having a general strike until this guy gets indicted, you know, maybe that would have been a shorter campaign. I don't know, but I feel like we're operating right now from a place where we're not putting out a clear analysis of how power works. And so I don't know. It's a little frustrating to me, but I feel like something has to be said about it. However, I think we need to tie it in with other movements so that we have some leverage.
And what's the big thing you're hoping folks will take away from your movie in terms of some of this issue of capitalism and the way it continues to hold on us?
Okay. One, there are a lot of things that I want people to take away from this movie. I tried to do something that in my mind was more akin to literature, where there are a lot of ideas. Like, I mean, if you take any piece of literature that you love and you say, what's the one thing about it? You'd be lying by, you know, omission. And so I wanted that to feel like that, like, you know, there are all these things. But I would say overarching is I wanted there to be a sense of optimism that although things are messed up and all these things are going on, if there's a fight with a clear way to win, if there's a fight going on, then that's the optimism, the hope. Right there. So I don't want to give away too much of what happens in the movie, but it is a strange odyssey.
It certainly is. Sorry to bother you, but we have to end. No, Boots Riley, writer and director of the acclaimed film, Sorry to Bother You.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
You are not a riot. You are a right-wing paramilitary assault upon you. You are not rebellion. You are a pretty piece of paper which is signed by murderers. You are not a riot. You are the tight leather pants on the old ex-general. You are not rebellion. I got the invite to your party and I threw it away. You are not a riot. You're an apologetic pad for the judge's gavel. Right spot, and my painting isn't finished till it kills.
You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards Tekert. It's really shaping up to be a big election year for housing issues in California. We're going to see an attempt to repeal state-level restrictions on the ability of cities to enact rent control on the statewide November ballot. Looks like a lot of bonds to fund affordable housing at the city level. Berkeley City Council just voted to put one on the ballot, $135 million, which, considering it's a city of about 115,000 people, is huge, particularly compared to past housing bonds. And it's really interesting that so much of it's happening at the local government level, because if you go back like 30 years in time, most of the funding streams for supplying affordable housing or for programs that would combat homelessness came from the federal government, came from housing and urban development. And the federal government definitely has the most means to pay, but has beat a full-scale retreat. I mean, even without retrenchments, they've kind of gotten out of the business of paying to build housing and diverted most of their resources into voucher programs like Section 8, which subsidize people moving into existing housing, which, if the fundamental problem is there's not enough housing out there for all the people that need it. In any case, it is not just residential tenants who are facing a displacement crisis. It is also businesses. In West Oakland, one of the lower bottom's few remaining black-owned community businesses, called the One Fam Collective, is fighting eviction at their 7th Street location. Once home to one of the most vibrant independent black communities in the nation, 7th Street's been hit hard by gentrification. Members of the One Fam Collective call their struggle a fight for control of their destiny. We have this report from Jody Strait.
The space where we get to all share our art, and it's a safe space for us where our art is going to be accepted and supported.
That's Anaya Baki. She is one of the many volunteers at the Revolution Cafe, part of Oakland's One Fam Collective. The community nonprofit comprises three businesses: the Bikes for Life bike shop, Revolution Cafe, and the One Fam Event Center. Its owners call it the last black-owned enterprise in the Lower Bottoms. One Fam founder and longtime community activist Tony Coleman.
We're going through some issues with, largely has to do with just the trend that's happening across the country with just displacement and gentrification. We're no different, but the only difference is in how we react and how we respond. And out here, we are more tend to following tradition of our folks that kind of like paved the way for us, like the Black Panthers. We're actually in a space where they had a lot of history in.
Arnie Fields, Coleman's landlord, attempted to evict all three of the One Fam businesses from the 7th Street building in late April, alleging unpaid rent for Revolution Cafe. But his attempt was thwarted late June when a judge vacated the eviction for two of the three businesses, Revolution Cafe and Bikes for Life. Due to a filing error, the One Fam Event Center, nestled in between the two, remains padlocked. Coleman says he's invested as much as $15,000 into building repairs that should have been covered by the landlord, such as roof repairs. He adds that Fields only recently came back into the picture following an acrimonious divorce. According to Coleman, Fields' former business partner and wife, Lucy LeQuinn, formerly managed the property and frequently negotiated the rent with him. A former mayoral candidate, Fields owns several properties in Oakland. He declined a comment to KPFA for this story. Last week, One Fam members delivered over 500 petitions to their landlord, urging him to negotiate with them. One Fam volunteer, Carolina Nita, from Chile, helped deliver the petitions and says Fields refuses to speak with the collective.
Arnie, unfortunately, is on that other half to where he won't even have a conversation with us. He hasn't even given us the dignity to see if there's something we can work out. He's just going, you know, through the motions to get the eviction without even trying to, you know, see all the work that we've put into this place while he's been vacant and an absent landlord, essentially.
Coleman started the One Fam Collective in 1996 to create a positive outlet for the community, which has been affected by reoccurring incidents of fatal police shootings of unarmed African Americans. The collective has served over 100 Oakland youth in mentorship programs, including formerly incarcerated individuals, and continues to serve incoming youth today. Coleman says programs like those make a crucial difference in the lives of participants.
A lot of our young folks that when they met us were on the verge of going either way, and we were able to come in the right time to be able to add a little, just enough of our influence to help them be able to make better choices and to be around good people. And so, you know, one fam first.
One fam volunteer and West Oakland native, Isaiah, spoke about how the group's looming eviction from the site, once a meeting ground for the Black Panthers, has impacted him.
If you didn't grow up out in this neighborhood, you would never knew that the Black Panthers would start here or how historical this street is. And like to see it now, like see how like they're pretty much trying to get rid of us, it's kind of heartbreaking. It's kind of like we're having that history stolen.
Coleman will likely be going to court with Fields as another eviction notice is expected due to back rent that Fields insists he is owed, up to $7,000. One fam has raised nearly $3,000 of its $10,000 fundraising goal, which can be found on their website, onefam.org/fight. For KPFA in Oakland, I'm Jody Strait.
That does it for today's show.
Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and our guests online, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect to us on social media. A big thanks to everyone who makes this show happen. Our producer is Corin Smith, engineer Kirsten Thomas. Our hosts are Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
That's me.
And me.
Antonia Juhas.
Gina Madrid and Janine Etter. Our interns are Justin Gold and Clara Sophia Daly. Also, Mitch Jezerich and Eileen Alfandary.
If you want to get in touch, but you can't send an email, put a stamp on an envelope with a letter in it to KPFA 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California 94704. Attention up front. Stay up and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way in 2 minutes at 9 o'clock.
Got a letter from the government the other day. Opened it and read it. It said there was
switching, switch on, switch off, many switching, switch on, switch off, switch on. Many switching, switch on, switch off, many switching, switch on, switch off, many switching, switch on, switch off. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man, and I could never be a veteran. On the strength of situations are real, I wrote a rule deal, so I'm looking for the steel, looking for the steel. I got a letter from the government the other day, opened and read it, it said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever, picture me.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Well, what we're trying to do today is bring the FCC a taste of what local viewers are experiencing all across the country.
People should care because this is how we get our news. This is how we know what's going on in our country.
What Sinclair has been doing for too long is pushing their political agenda on the public airwaves, forcing local stations to air talking points from the White House, forcing local journalists putting words in their mouths.
The fight to really stop this Sinclair merger is something that is, I admit, it is a David and Goliath fight.
Ever since the Trump administration took office and appointed Ajit Pai as head of the FCC, he has aided and abetted Sinclair's expansion at every turn.
The public is not in support of this. The people do not want this merger to go through. Sinclair is the largest local news station in the news company in the country, and if this merger goes through, they would just get even bigger.
If you were to go to college and they said one professor is going to teach 70% of your classes, you would think that was silly. It was ridiculous. You'd think we weren't going to get enough perspective. How are you going to make sure that you have, like, not only depth of content, but really to understand the material? But here, this is very similar to what Sinclair is asking the FCC to approve.
Sinclair has repeatedly forced their stations to air their must-run content, which is not content that is from the public, from our local news stations, and is forcing our public to see the same thing over and over again.
Very often, those communities of color rely on their local news because they don't have access to cable or satellite or other broadband platforms to basically get a diversity of viewpoints. So essentially, you're watching one conservative station that gives you their version of the news and that also paints how we perceive each other. So you would essentially be able to be shaping who neighbors think is a threat. You'd be able to decide Are these people dangerous when they're constantly depicting maybe African Americans on the news as criminals and depicting Latinos on the news as all of these immigrants who are crossing our borders and they can't be U.S. citizens? Those things slowly but surely seep into the American consciousness, and it's hard to separate that.
Local news needs to reflect the concerns of the many and of all of us, and not just of the wealthy, powerful few.
And that's a short video created by Media Matters for America featuring a number of activists who delivered 600,000 signatures on a petition against the Sinclair Tribune Media merger to the FCC just a few days ago. Among the people featured in that video was my guest, Craig Aaron. So do you see Ajit Pai's now doubt on the Sinclair Tribune merger as a direct result of the petition that you helped to deliver and a victory?
I definitely see it as a victory. And, you know, in some ways, I'm still pulling my jaw up off the floor that Ajit Pai, who has been Sinclair's best friend in Washington and up until Monday was doing everything he could to aid and abet everything Sinclair wanted at the FCC, you know, did a 180 and moved in completely the opposite direction and in favor of the public interest. And so I think there were a variety of factors that may have influenced that decision, although he's not saying. But one of them unquestionably was public pressure, and the fact that that public pressure really kept Sinclair in the spotlight. Sinclair has gone, despite its size, from being an obscure company that no one really had heard about, because when you turn on your TV, you don't see Sinclair. You generally see ABC or CBS or NBC, even if it's a Sinclair-owned station, to one that, you know, suddenly was in the public consciousness and people were aware of. And we've seen the incredible activism. We were outside the FCC last week. A month earlier, there was a big protest that we organized outside Sinclair's shareholder meeting, really helping to raise the pressure on Sinclair. And I think that has some influence on the FCC. I think they also got pressure from the right. And there are a lot of conservatives who don't like the idea of one company, in the case of Sinclair, controlling so much of conservative media, conservative output. So they were getting hit by from a number of angles. And I think they, in many ways, misplayed their hand. If you read between the lines of what the FCC put out on Monday, it suggests that they felt misled by Sinclair, that Sinclair's efforts to control stations, to say they were selling them, but just to sell them off to a crony who then signs back control to Sinclair, that this FCC still had some issues with that. And honestly, I'm surprised as anyone. And those have been stories that have been out at the press. We've been talking about the scandal that is the way that Sinclair does business for a long time. But something happened and Ajit Pai changed his tune in a pretty remarkable way. He's also under investigation for his dealings with the company. That may have had some influence. But whatever the reason, I'm thrilled at the possibility. We're not quite there yet, but there's now a strong possibility that this deal could be derailed.
What is the justification that Ajit Pai and others are giving to calling this deal into question? I mean, it seems clear to you and I that we don't want to see a single institution controlling so much media, but media consolidation hasn't generally been a concern of the government's, unfortunately. Are they citing specific sort of antitrust laws?
No, that's not necessarily the purview of the FCC. So they're in charge of the license transfers, and, you know, media concentration is their purview, although this FCC has moved to lift restrictions on media concentration. So,
and didn't Sinclair say that it would sort of sell off some stations so that it would be able to comply with any FCC requirements?
Well, they did, but this is where things get complicated. And again, reading between the lines, they haven't put out the order publicly, although commissioners have indicated their intention to vote for the draft that was circulated. But based on what we've seen and what's been reported, the FCC seems to be saying, and these are pretty serious charges in the world of the FCC, that they felt misled. And the basis for that seems to be that Sinclair has issued a number of divestment plans. But the fact is that in many cases, their promises to divest or sell off stations were really fictitious. And what they were doing is they were selling stations to, for example, Armstrong Williams, the conservative commentator who was being set up as an owner in name only. His name was going to be on the license, but his first act was very clearly going to be to then sign over control, advertising, sales, and everything else back to Sinclair.
Wow.
They were also doing
That's pretty blatant.
It is. And yet the FCC seemed to be giving them a wink and a nod that that was going to be okay. And now they've completely changed their tune. And maybe just because it is so blatant. For example, WGN, the big Chicago station, the flagship of Tribune, found on many people's cable packages, you know, that was going to be sold off to a car dealer in Baltimore who had a close business relationship with the executive chairman of Sinclair. And so essentially this famous TV station, you know, with the history going back into the early part of last century, was going to be run out of a closet in Towson, Maryland, and essentially, again, run by Sinclair. It seems that this FCC has thrown up their hands and said, that's not good enough, and cut off negotiations with Sinclair and said, we're sending this to an administrative law judge, which, again, it sort of sounds confusing, like, okay, designated for a hearing, but in FCC speak, that's kind of like when you tell your kids that the family pet is going to live on a farm. Usually when deals are put back to the administrative law judges, that's when they fall apart. That's right. What happened with AT&T and T-Mobile and Comcast and Time Warner. So there's a lot of indication, and the stock market certainly reacted like this deal could indeed be dead, although it's not officially dead yet.
So essentially Sinclair tried to pretend to sell off stations, but we're keeping it in the family. According to Think Progress, Ajit Pai has said that the FCC would require Sinclair to explain its divestitures before a judge in order to move forward with the merger, effectively killing the deal in the process. And do you feel that, and you alluded to this earlier, Ajit Pai being under investigation himself, that he may have relaxed to certain rules around broadcasting to help Sinclair? It's in his interest to make it clear that he is as impartial as possible if he is under investigation. So
no question about it. But what's so remarkable about this turn of events is that at every other turn, when members of Congress, for example, wrote to the chairman of the FCC, Ajit Pai, and said, you need to step back from this deal while you're under investigation, he refused. So, you know, at every step of the way, he did the thing to benefit Sinclair until here in sort of the final hours of this deal, he went absolutely the other way. So there's still a lot to figure out about how and why this happened. But for today, I think we'll be glad that it did happen and seems to have put this deal in jeopardy. And there are a couple other things still playing out that may have been factors, including a court case. My group, Free Press, joined with some allies, and we've sued the FCC over some of these rule changes done to benefit Sinclair. And we could see a decision in one of those cases within a matter of days. And those close courtroom observers, independent courtroom observers, think the FCC does not have a good case and did not think they did well at the oral arguments. So there may be a factor there, too, because that could put the deal in jeopardy. But whatever it is, you know, I find myself in the very unusual position of saying to Ajit Pai, thank you. You did the right thing. It might be the first time since he's been the FCC chairman just about that I've wanted to say that. But there's no question in this case, he absolutely did that and broke with the kind of expectations that one would think this administration would be actually pursuing Sinclair's agenda. In this case, they didn't.
We should remind our audience of how dangerous a network it is. It was in the news just recently, I believe a few months ago, for being exposed for having forced its anchors around the country to read these scripts around so-called fake news that exposed what would happen if Sinclair continued to grow unabated, that you would just have talking points released by some central newsroom somewhere to put forward, you know, a sort of propaganda that very directly feeds into Trump's political agenda, right?
Well, that's absolutely right. And that really, you know, there is the basic problem of Sinclair, which is just too much media power and too few hands. No one company should control 230 television stations reaching 72% of the country. That should be out of bounds. But Sinclair is an especially bad company to give that power because they force all of their local affiliates in between sports and weather and the normal local reporting you would expect to find on a TV station to run these reactionary right-wing commentaries, these slanted national packages that demonize the Muslim American community, that go after activists, especially those protesting police violence. So you have this xenophobic, racist, Islamophobic content that they are forcing local stations to run everywhere alongside content and commentators who are literally reading straight from Donald Trump's talking points. And whatever the issue is, whether it's, you know, the attacks in Charlottesville, caging kids on the border, you know, all of the worst things that have happened during the Trump administration, Sinclair's commentators have been there to defend the Trump administration. And this was thought to be their leg up in getting things done in the Trump administration. But it has been exposed. And that video in particular, a version that was put out by the sports website Deadspin, broke through and went viral. And it reached more people than all of the investigative reporting and all of my outreaches. 30 million people watched this video of their local anchors being force-fed this script, all reading it at the same time. And it really woke people up to the danger of, you know, one company controlling so much of the news, one company forcing this cookie cutter content. It really angered viewers and it really angered journalists. I've gotten more calls from disgruntled people inside the newsroom in the last 3 months than probably the last 3 years beforehand, because they've had enough. And it seems that now even the FCC has had enough. So Sinclair, a company that was thought to be able to write their own ticket here, has found that they've overreached so much and they've done so many things that their deal's actually now in trouble. Yeah. Which is good for those local viewers, at least those viewers who don't yet have Sinclair stations, which is fortunately now at least some of us.
Right. We played that video on our show as well. Now, Craig, if Sinclair were to somehow merge with Tribune Media, how much would its reach increase by? How much more power would it have? And even if the merger doesn't go through, it doesn't stop Sinclair from trying to gobble up local stations and expand its reach in other ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, they could certainly come back and try, although, you know, this, if this deal indeed falls apart, this is a very big loss for Sinclair, but they still do control, you know, north of 150 television stations all across the country, including in a lot of electorally important swing states, as well as big markets like their home market of Baltimore and here in Washington, D.C. But if they got this deal done, or if they get it done in part, they're talking about really a massive expansion, you know, going from reaching, you know, a little more than a third of the country to, you know, almost three quarters of the country, because this deal with Tribune includes stations in New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Dallas, Seattle, like big, big markets that would give them a bigger reach than they've ever had before. And there is a possibility that they will negotiate to get some of those stations, although it doesn't look good. And when you look at what Tribune put out today, they seem to be indicating that they have strong concerns this deal is going to happen at all. But it doesn't mean Sinclair doesn't have any power, because they've already shown that they're very influential, especially in the Midwest, in states like Ohio, West Virginia, other places, electorally important states, that they have incredible influence, and they go to politicians. This is their business model, and say, hey, we can reach more local viewers than CNN. Spend your ad dollars with us. So Sinclair is not going away, even if they don't get this deal done, but this would certainly be a major setback to their ambitions. And when you combine that with the public awareness about what they're trying to do, how they're trying to slant coverage and favor one political party very much over the other, you know, it certainly sets them on a path where there's a lot more. They can't get away with it as easily as they did in previous elections. There's been serious damage to the brand, and hopefully people are waking up, but that doesn't mean they don't still need to be counteracted and watched closely.
Craig, we often have you on our program to discuss the issue of net neutrality, and there has been some news around that issue. The common thread here is, of course, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, who pushed through an evisceration of net neutrality, which now basically means the only place where we can formally revive that principle that protects internet freedom is in Congress. And a Republican named Mike Kaufman has just introduced a bill on Tuesday. Tell us a little bit about this, and is it a glimmer of hope?
I think it is a glimmer of hope, maybe even a little more than a glimmer, because in addition to introducing this legislation, he did something really important, and that is he put his name, his signature on what's called a discharge petition in the House of Representatives in support of a piece of legislation introduced by Rep. Mike Doyle from Pittsburgh called the Congressional Review Act, which would overturn what the FCC did. And so in doing so, Kaufman becomes the first Republican in the House to join 176 delegates Democrats in supporting this legislation. In order to have this bill move in the House, we're going to need 218 members of Congress on board, which will involve a significant number of Republicans. Today, Kaufman opened the door to that possibility. This is a piece of legislation, as we've talked about, that already passed the United States Senate in a bipartisan fashion. So this is a step toward potentially overturning what the FCC did. And that's a very good sign. And I think it reflects a couple of things. One, it just shows net neutrality does not need to be a partisan issue. It is very much a bipartisan issue. And what Mike Kaufman is finding out as a member of Congress in a swing district is that his constituents really care about this issue. He's hearing about it when he's at home. He indicated he heard about it when he was on a tour of military bases in the Middle East, that young Marines were coming up to him to talk about net neutrality. So this issue has broken through like never before. It's becoming a political issue, and you're seeing politicians like Kaufman respond to that public pressure from their constituents. There have been people in his district protesting week after week, calling attention to it, and today we saw those results. So I take it as a very, very positive sign that we could begin to see legislation move in the House against what the FCC did, which of course would be a tremendous rebuke to Ajit Pai and what he's trying to do.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
was turned away from every doll like Joseph, to even the toughest among us. That would be too much. He didn't know what it was to be black till they gave him his change, but didn't want to touch his hand. To even the toughest among us, don't you know that would be too much. Just enough, how hard it is to live. Isn't it hard enough just to make it through a day? The secret of their fear and their suspicion. A little afraid, coming from where he did. He was such a dignified child. To even the toughest among us, don't you know that would be too much. Isn't it just enough how hard it is to live?
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are looking at the many different lies associated with the events of September the 11th. John Gold's book with 31 interviews is titled, We Were Lied To About 9/11. John Gold, talk to us a little bit about the contents of your interviews and the kind of people that you wanted to include and why.
again, you know, I wanted people that were part of the story for the most part, as well as the best researchers out there. My last interview, which I didn't think was going to happen, which I actually hoped would be my first interview, was with Paul Thompson, the creator of the complete 9/11 timeline, available at www.historycommons.org. That was almost a four-hour conversation, and that was a wonderful conversation. But, you know, I spoke to as many people that were part of the story as I could. I spoke to Lori Van Auken, who was the Jersey girl, one of the four widows responsible for the creation of the 9/11 Commission. Think about that we would not even, as corrupted and compromised as the 9/11 Commission was, we would not even have had that if not for the family members, the Jersey girls. For the September 11th advocates, you want to refer to them as.
The George W. Bush administration, in fact, lobbied Congress to not formally investigate the crimes of 9/11 and tried to derail it at every turn for over 400 days. And again, this is one of the, Lori Van Auken is one of the fabulous interviews that you did, and also the subject of a film, 9/11 Press for Truth, which is, again, a pretty old film by now, but definitely tells that story. So who else, John?
Ray Novoselsky, who was the director of 9/11 Press for Truth, which was the story about the cover-up from the perspective of the 9/11 family members, the Jersey girls, as well as Sally Regenhardt, Bob McElveen, Monica Gabrielle. And it basically, in my opinion, destroyed the legitimacy of the 9/11 Commission within the first half hour. It opened up a whole slew of topics that really weren't covered to the extent that they should have been. And it was based on Paul Thompson's amazing complete 9/11 timeline. So that was an important interview. I spoke with Eric Larson, and Eric is one of the people who was responsible for going to the National Archives and putting online for people upwards of 8,000 documents from the 9/11 Commission. And I dedicated that show to John Judge. Basically, John was a big fan of looking at documentation, official documentation that may contradict what are being made as public statements by politicians and so forth. That's a great way of showing that they're lying. So that's kind of what we talked about. I had Cindy Sheehan on, who's a Gold Star mother, lost her son in the Iraq War, has been a huge anti-war activist. I had New York Times reporter Phil Sheenan, who was the New York Times reporter at the time of the 9/11 Commission, was tasked with covering the 9/11 Commission for the New York Times. And each interview has a description of what the show is going to be about and what it is going to show you. For instance, for our second show, which was Chapter 2, Episode 2, I said this week's show is going to focus on how the corporate media has treated those who question what we were told about 9/11. It is greatly because of how the corporate media has treated us that many people with followings won't talk about the multitude of cover-ups concerning 9/11. It is greatly because of how the corporate media has treated us that many people think that 9/11 truthers or advocates for 9/11 justice are the equivalent of a baby killer or a dog torturer. It is greatly because of how the corporate media has treated us that we have failed to reach the critical mass necessary to resolve this issue. If the corporate media did its job, I would not have had to devote almost 12 years of my life to this cause. I ask you, in what world does it make sense to constantly attack and misrepresent those seeking truth, accountability, and justice for the murder of 2,977 people? You know, certainly not in the world I choose to be a part of. And that entire discussion was about the problems with the corporate news, which is such a big issue for not only the 9/11 issue, but for every cause.
Indeed, John Gold. And that goes back to Nick Johnson, FCC commissioner from the 60s and 70s, who wrote a book called Your Second Priority that said just that. No matter what your first issue or cause or concern is, if your second isn't on media freedom, media reform, or press freedom issues, you're likely to gain little traction in your first. And of course, that's definitely true of 9/11. You know, Philip Sheenan, by the way, wrote a book called The Commission, right, looking at the history of the 9/11 investigation. And of course, historiographically, I know some people disagree with some of the conclusions that might be there. But again, I think it's important to look at the 31 interviews you did, because they actually have a pretty broad perspective. It's not just any one particular angle. I guess you could argue that all of the people you talk to at least have a general agreement that we haven't been told the truth about 9/11, and we don't know
absolutely
right all the details about 9/11. And again, I find that to be hardly a radical premise, and I only say that because of the blowback, the attacks, and so forth that you have received, that Jenna has received, for saying things that are just on the face of it just fundamentally true.
Absolutely. And here's another show that I did with 9/11 whistleblower Colleen Rowley, and this is the description for the show. This week's show is going to focus on the importance of whistleblowing. Many people have put their jobs, their lives, and their freedom on the line. If not for many of the whistleblowers that have come forward, we would not know about much of the corruption taking place within our government and elsewhere. They are an essential part of having a true democracy, and in my opinion, should be treated like the heroes that they are.
John Gold, let's talk very briefly, if we can, about Colleen Rowley, because just like you mentioned earlier, one of the hurdles people had, the hurdle that you said Jenna Orkin helped break down for you and remove for you, the idea that the U.S. government wouldn't do X to its own people, etc. And in the case of the 9/11 environmental fallout, we can see what's capable, right, what they're capable of. But in this other case, mentioning Colleen Rowley, she was in the FBI, correct?
Yes.
And a whistleblower. One of the issues you often hear with people that claim to be skeptical about 9/11 alternative narratives, rather than skeptical about the official narrative itself, is that, well, there would be people coming out and saying things, and there would be more whistleblowers. Well, I mean, come on, you've got Thomas Drake, you've got Colleen Rowley, many others. What about Colleen Rowley?
Well, Colleen Rowley, very early on, Robert Mueller made a statement saying to the effect that it was news that some of the alleged hijackers trained at flight schools and inside of America. And if they had known that, they might have been able to have avert what had happened. But the fact of the matter is, since 1996, flight schools have been targeted for investigations as far as, you know, Middle Eastern men training to fly and stuff like that. So she wrote a letter or a memo saying that statements like that should not be made. And a few days later, Robert Mueller said the magical two words that most people in the Bush administration were saying, was that there were no warnings.
From Kofor Black to Colleen Rowley, the CIA, multiple countries' intelligence agencies, I mean, even just internally here in the U.S. with the FBI and CIA, we knew that there were so many issues going on. People were being warned not to board planes, high-profile people the summer of before 9/11 took place in 2001. And again, Colleen Rowley is a classic example. By the way, that Robert Mueller is the same Mueller that is being both lauded by liberals, but now somehow castigated by conservatives, the same Robert Mueller. So you mentioned Colleen Rowley as someone that had warnings that were ignored. Again, all the while people saying, well, there was no way we could have known that this would happen, right? I mean, including Condoleezza Rice, who testified to the 9/11 commission that they had no idea planes could be used as weapons, even though she delivered a report to then-President Bush basically saying exactly that.
One of the things that George Bush used to say a lot is that if he had any inkling whatsoever that there was going to be an attack on American soil, he would have moved heaven and earth. And it seemed like a talking point because he used to say that quite a lot. And within the last 2 years, Condoleezza Rice made virtually the exact same statement, which just tells me that was just one big talking point. This book is very important because a lot of the interviews took place at the time when things like ISIS were being formed, and we were telling people the absolute truth of how ISIS came into being. So it's a great historical perspective, and there are other things like that within the book that were taking place in real time that we talked about that were important. Now, with regards to Jonathan Kay wrote a book called Among the Truthers. He interviewed a multitude of people. A lot of people I would not have recommended that he interview as opposed to other people. And, you know, he essentially put everybody into a bad light. So I interviewed him because I wanted to show how wrong he was about the subject. And I think I did a fairly good job at that. But one of the things that he did and he discussed, and this is something that we've been seeing all around, Jonathan Kay was considered a neoconservative. He belonged to an organization where Michael Ledeen belonged to it, James Woolsey, I forget what it was called, but it was a neoconservative think tank. And what he told me during the interview is that no, he doesn't consider himself a neoconservative anymore. And like many quote-unquote neoconservatives, they're now admitting that the Iraq war was a mistake. Some of them are. And those are the ones that seem to be becoming neoliberal. Like a lot of the neoliberals seem to be adopting a lot of the views of people who we used to consider, you know, neoconservative.
One of the things that you've highlighted in a lot of the different interviews you've done is the failure amongst the journalistic class, or our so-called free press, as Mark Crispin Miller would say in aerial quotes. So let's talk about that. What do you have to say about the way journalists have handled some of these false statements and ongoing cover-ups regarding 9/11?
Well, as I said, if real legitimate journalists had done the job that they should have done, and many of them tried to do it, you know, their jobs, but they were let go. Robert Scheer, another example of that. But journalists who have written stories without the filter that we were lied to about 9/11, that we don't know the truth about 9/11, they're helping to write a history that's simply untrue, that's dangerous, because it allows the establishment to continue to use that day as it has been used. It has to stop. It just has to stop. And I wrote in my book, in the introduction, I said, to those journalists who consider themselves alternative press, but don't incorporate the fact that we were lied to about 9/11 or don't know the truth about 9/11 into whatever post-9/11 related story they report about, I have this to say. You are helping to create an extremely dangerous environment. History is being written, and it's simply the wrong history. Please consider your stance on the issue of 9/11. Thank you. You know, I can't be any more candid than that, really. You know, and we're seeing today, like ICE. ICE is an issue now. Why did ICE come into being? Because of 9/11, specifically. You know, Department of Homeland Security, ICE. These are things that were created as a direct result of 9/11. And if we were lied to about 9/11, that takes away the justification for these organizations. You know, we have Gitmo, we have warrantless wiretapping, we have the USA Freedom Act, which replaced the Patriot Act. We have all of these things that are a direct result. The wars are still being fought using 9/11 as the legal justification to do so. People that we murdered and slaughtered and wounded and displaced in foreign countries that had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. This is a crime, a massive crime against humanity being done in the name of that day that we don't even know the truth about. And that's just horrible. And the families both deserve and require absolute truth, justice, and accountability for what happened. And I'd like to quickly say something about the families. Some of the families right now have started a site called www.declassify911.org, and it has a petition for people to sign, because the families and those who pay attention want everything having to do with 9/11 released completely unredacted, which we have not seen, even though in 2009 the 9/11 Commission said that they would release all documentation, and they have yet to do so. I think only 35% has been released, and a lot of it is redacted, and so on and so forth.
I know you've done research about this, and that's one Philip Zelikow, who's a PhD historian. He was one of the lead editors behind the 9/11 Commission report that was published, and there are hosts of conflicts of interest around Zelikow. Can you remind our listeners about him? And I believe he's at the University of Virginia now.
I believe so, but I don't know if he's teaching at the moment. You know, he wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice. He essentially wrote the preemptive war strategy to get into Iraq. He essentially was responsible for making sure that Richard Clark was no longer part of the cabinet, that he was put into a subordinate position. This was the counterterrorism czar of the day. During the time of the 9/11 Commission, he was responsible for the questions that would be asked, who would be questioned, and he would set up the 9/11 Commission so that it was, you know, nobody could talk to each other, or the staff couldn't talk to the 9/11 commissioners. Many of the staff secretly would talk to the 9/11 commissioners to warn them about things that Zelikow was doing. And I just want to remind people that Zelikow was selected by Karl Rove, and also Thomas Keane was selected by Karl Rove. First off, how trustworthy is Karl Rove? Obviously not at all. So there were allegations during the time of the 9/11 Commission that Karl Rove was speaking with Philip Zelikow, and Zelikow told his secretary to destroy the notes or to not keep records of the phone calls. My God, it's such a conflict of interest. He was doing everything within his power to rewrite the 9/11 report so that it was more favorable. He blocked half of the interview requests for Saudi investigators. He blocked Dana Liesemann, who came from the Joint Congressional Inquiry, over to the 9/11 Commission, who helped to author the 28 redacted pages that were made famous. And he blocked her access to them. And as a result, she went through a back channel to gain access to that information. And as a result, Zelikow fired her. And unfortunately, she has passed away. So, you know, the further away we get from 9/11, the harder it's going to be to get to the truth. You know, Philip Zelikow, as far as I'm concerned, he belongs in prison. The book is available for free. Anybody can go there and download it. If you feel the work is worthy, you can leave a donation, but it's not necessary to get the book. You know, I didn't do these things all these years to keep it to myself. And I certainly didn't do it so that only the fortunate who can afford something could read it. I wanted to make it available for everyone.
Is there any place to hear the audio interviews?
There are two links in the book. One is to archives.org. All of the interviews are available there. Another is on my YouTube channel, which is Gold9472.
They bombed innocent people trying to murder Saddam. When you gave them those chemical weapons to go to war with Iran, this is the information that they hold back from Peter Jennings. This Condoleezza Rice is just a new age Sally Hemings. I break it down with critical language and spiritual anguish. The Judas I hang with, the guilt of betraying Christ, who murdered him, stole his religion and painted him white, translated in psychologically tainted philosophy, conservative political right wing ideology, glued together sloppily. The blasphemy of a nation. Got my back to the wall cause I'm facing assassination. Guantanamo Bay, federal incarceration. How could this be? The land of the free, home of the brave, indigenous Holocaust, and the home of the slaves. Corporate America, dancing offbeat to the rhythm. You really think this country never sponsored terrorism? Human rights violations, we continue the saga. El Salvador and the Contras and Nicaragua. And on top of that, you still want to take me to prison just because I won't trade humanity for patriotism.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Well, the crops are all in and the peaches are rotten. The oranges are filing their creosote dawns. I'm flying them back to the Mexican border. Take all that money to weed back again. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita. Adios mis amigos, Jesus Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All it'll call you will be devotee. Now my father's own father, he waited that room. They took all the money that he made in his land. 600 miles to the Mexican border. Chased like rustlers, like outlaws, like thieves. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalie. Adios mis amigos, Jesus Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All it will call you will be deported. Well, a skyplane caught fire over Los Gatos Canyon. Great ball of fire, well, it shook all our hills. Who are these dear friends who are falling like dry leaves? Radio said they had just deported. Well, is this the best way we can grow our big orchards? Is this the best way we can raise our good crops? To fall like dry leaves and rot on the topsoil, be known by no name except deported. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalie. Adios mis amigos, Jesus Maria.
You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All who will call you will be devotee.
Kid, and this is Twit Wit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time. Are we ready?
Ready.
Check.
Present.
Here.
I'm chipping.
We have a quorum.
The category is hip hypnosis for 100 points. Give a half true answer to this question. Who benefits?
Who benefits from what?
Repeat the question, please. Mass hip hypnosis. Who benefits?
The mass hip hypnotists.
The 1%.
Building 7.
We have a tie. Everybody loses. And before we go any further, hello? Before we go on, are there any announcements?
1984 has been rescheduled for later in the year.
Any other announcements?
I have an announcement.
Go ahead.
There's no sugar in the condiment bowl.
The facilitator has his hand up.
I have an important announcement. The mystery guest is lying on the floor in the restroom.
Lil Wayne?
His brother, Lil Dwayne.
Is he breathing? Is he breathing? Well, his breathing is fine.
Enhanced brain function, not fine.
A brain tissue replacement surgery. It's a growing field.
Like eugenics.
All right, bring him in. Okay, now, everyone please put on your blindfolds. Good. The panelist who correctly identifies the mystery guest wins. Take a seat.
I can take it, and sometimes I leave it.
You get 3 clues.
Is the mystery guest an animal, a vegetable, or mineral?
Man, I ain't even human. Why were you passed out on the floor in the restroom? I saw a butterfly in hell today.
Who wrote your first #1 hit rap song?
Lollipop. Man, I wrote Lollipop.
I would like to make a guess.
Okay. Who is the mystery guest?
Are you Lil Wayne?
Hell no. Wayne owes me money. Young money, honey is money on hotcakes with a slice of warm toast in my back pocket. Like father, like son.
You have 2 more clues.
Are you a lifelike drone? On my life. Well, are you Little Wayne's long-lost twin brother, Dwayne? On my life.
We have a winner.
That's excellent.
What is Lil Dwayne talking about?
My twin brother, Lil Wayne. He was born 3 minutes after me. See, I got the jump.
The mystery guest is Lil Wayne's older twin brother, Lil Dwayne.
Dwayne and Wayne were separated at birth by military doctors for secret brain tissue experiments on twin boys.
I don't care about the royalties. I want the credit, man. I wrote Twat Tie My Hands. Wayne walks off with a Grammy.
Lil Dwayne, is that true?
That's what I've been saying. A black pearl night out on the town. Big as my what? I don't know today.
Who are you really?
Well, identity is an artificial construction of the mind.
It lacks substance. Nothing is real.
There is no objective reality.
Not even a little bit?
Sentimental hogwash.
I am God's gift to the universe. I can't believe that.
You know, little Dwayne has had a long day.
It was a difficult operation.
The mystery guest wishes to remain anonymous. Why?
It's a mystery.
From some other planet.
Lil Wayne is a Martian. What does that say about me?
And your mother and father?
Space aliens?
Not even human.
And my transhumanoid grandma and the horse she drove into the ground through 8 feet of snow, leaning into the wind, the Birdman sings. A Wayne bot drone so lifelike, he looks like me. But everybody knows Lil Wayne is a Google self-driving Wayne bot, a clone of me. I wrote Lollipop, no mechanical Wayne bot can do it. It's me. Lil Dwayne is the freestyle king of the Martians. Wayne is a pirate made from space parts, left over from the space program. Lil Wayne owes me unpaid loyalties from the song factory in my mind. Vaporizing the horizon we do not see. God bless America, my country, tis of thee. Sweet land to kill them all and let them die.
My country, tis of thee. Sweet land to kill them all and let them die. God bless America. This old godless America. Her tomorrow ain't promised today. The end of time is like an hour away. Damn, military minded, lost it, can't find it. The stars on the flag are never shining. I saw a butterfly in hell today. Will I die or go to jail today?
Round two, the category is droning the brain. For 30 points, give an unpopular answer to this question. When is the best time to panic?
Panic early.
Panic in stages.
Klonopin.
We have a loser.
But on Klonopin, I'm inappropriately calm on the emergency staircase.
Please don't be stupid.
I have an extra Paxil if you need one.
I'm talking with brain scientists working with the Rockefeller Institute of Micro-Cyber Rotation Therapy and Bank Fraud.
The Brain Initiative is a great leap forward.
Forward to where?
When we get there, I will submit a report.
Is the Brain Initiative going to mess with my mind?
Absolutely not.
Fact check.
It's a done deal. Half of Brain Initiative funds are budgeted for public health benefit. The other half is secret.
DARPA.
Why is the Pentagon getting half of all the research money?
I'm Lil Wayne's brain. Lil Wayne's brain. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. Yeah, on the mic. Bashed out in the bathroom, but I'm all right. And I can stare into the light bulb. Nothing comes back and makes me feel full. I got some tea, and I'm looking at my people now. They don't see me, and I don't even see them how. Cause I'm a Martian, I am up in the sky. I keep going all day, you know that I'm so fly. I got nothing on my mind, nothing in my brain. People say I'm crazy, I just say insane. They can't even see me for what I really am. I got a brother who's famous, and I got nothing.
Secret is safe, no hiding place, just no one near.
Hydra is bad news, little Dwayne.
One day, there will be a cure.
With a patent pending.
Where's the rest of me? Can someone translate?
I'm Kid Berkeley, sitting in for Berkeley Kid, who returns next week. We are talking with Lil Dwayne, the long-lost twin brother of the hip-hop sensation Lil Wayne. Also here is Lil Dwayne's personal medical team.
No names, please.
Top secret government brain surgeons are required to remain anonymous.
And I got the placebo.
Is that true?
The Department of Homeland Security neither confirms nor denies that medical experiments were conducted on twin boys separated at birth.
What kind of experiment?
Well, experiments designed to increase brain function.
Top secret rat experiments.
Are these microphones on?
If little Wayne had a long-lost twin brother, wouldn't we all know about it by now?
How would you keep it a secret?
Change the subject.
Random distractions. Frank Sinatra?
George Orwell wrote Animal Farm. Allegory, it's so easy to read. George Orwell, what does it mean? That I get a kick out of you. George, like the anarchist in Spain. An activist who was known to insist all animals are equal too, though some are more equal than you. I get a kick every time I see the state police on a killing spree. I get a kick, and it's clear to me the military does not adore me. I get kicked off of the plane for pointing out chemtrails in the sky. It's my idea of reporting the news. George Orwell's a kick.
Yes.
Ouch.
Orwell's trick.
Yes.
To get a kick out of you.
Voices are Rachel and Gracie. Garrett Eaton is in the studio with Lil Dwayne and a team of experimental brain surgeons from the third ring of Saturn.
The gods are everywhere.
Listeners can post TwitWit at hashtag TwitWit Radio. And I have a TwitWit here that says, Madame Blavatsky loves Mother Teresa.
It's funny, but it lacks wit.
Well, this is true. We have a wild affair. Nude bathing in the Ganges River. Candle waxing each other in Father Murphy's Lamborghini. Joseph Stalin said, the best friendships are based on misunderstandings.
10-point penalty, wandering all over the place.
Madame Blavatsky is so lifelike.
Yes, but Mother Teresa is the zombie robot from hell.
Well, eventually, all celebrities will be brain-enhanced clone bots.
Pick up the long bone. That is my why. The what? The way of how. Rare area. The actual show, invisible sight. The lone drone is the only clone to own. Can you roll with that?
And now, back to our story.
Caller on line 3.
Go ahead, caller. Do you have a question for Lil Dwayne?
I am anonymous, president of the Lil Dwayne fan club. Lil Dwayne is a god. I'm calling because I was promised cash money to be the president of the Lil Dwayne fan club. I want my money. Your check's out. That's a violation of my trust. I'm warning you. If I don't get paid, I will expose you. I know what's really going on. I will tell everybody the truth. Lil Wayne being a clone of his twin brother, Lil Dwayne. Lil Dwayne writes all the songs, not Lil Wayne. Lil Wayne does doesn't even exist. He's just a clone of Lil Dwayne. The world has been fooled by massive hypnosis and confused the fans, and nobody can figure out what's happening. Why do we see police gang violence in all the videos? God Bless America was produced by the Pentagon Film Office. I want my money, pay me now, or I will tell the world everything I know about the military entertainment state infiltration of the music industry and the chaos thing, because when it comes to...
Hello, caller? Caller, are you there?
The line is dead.
The military entertainment state doesn't mess around.
I was afraid this would happen.
Cut to something.
One, two, three.
I got a police drone that is stalking me, but I won't be another detainee. I'm gonna shoot him down.
I'm gonna shoot him down.
Drones fall fast.
I'm gonna shoot him down because drones fall fast.
Because I'm telling you now, drones do crash. Well, and now, back to our story. Caller, are you there?
I told you before, the military entertainment state doesn't mess around.
The line is still dead. What does that mean?
Order out of chaos is trending.
Is it just me, or is creepy fascism picking up speed?
I've been saying.
He's alive.
Dwayne, can you hear me? Do you know your name? Can you say what day it is? Hello? Lil Dwayne. How many fingers am I holding up?
Just the one. The same finger that you always hold up.
Dwayne, take a deep breath, Dwayne. It's me, your parole officer, Dr. Anonymous.
And the wicked nurse from hell.
Oh, I love the wicked nurse from hell.
You are listening to TwitWit Radio. We are talking with Lil Wayne's twin brother, Lil Dwayne.
Berkeley Kid has a serious belief disorder going on.
I have to be somewhere.
I've never had a guest die on my show. Is Lil Dwayne dying?
I'm going down, down, down.
Dwayne, who do we notify? Who's your next of kin?
Call my brother Wayne. Give him this. It's my last will. Brother Wayne, when I die, all the rights to my music go to Dr. Anonymous.
Well, that's very, very generous. Thank you, Dwayne.
And $100 million goes to Nurse Wicked, my brain transplant surgeon.
Thank you, Dwayne.
His eyes are rolled back into his head.
Is he dead yet?
Dwayne, can you hear me? Who is the president?
The sky is falling, and the only thing that can save us now is sensitivity and compassion. But I know one thing's for sure.
Yeah, some say tragedy's hard to get over, but sometimes that tragedy means it's over. Soldier from the academy, legal rollers, I deny being down, though they seem to hold us. My shoulders are strong, I prove them wrong. I ain't doing nothing but moving on, let the truth be known. And they thought that freedom matters, and didn't even leave a ladder. Damn.
I work at the corner store, and we all got problems. We ain't gonna fight alone. No one can save us now. How you feel? You're not alone. We're all just jealous. We don't reach for the sky no more. We just can't overflow.
Hope isn't home. Fate's not around. The luck's all gone. Don't ask me what's wrong. Ask me what's right. And I'ma tell you what's life. And did you know I lost everything? But I ain't the only one. First came the hurricane, then the morning sun. Excuse me if I'm on one. And don't trip if I light one. I walk a tight one. They try to tell me keep my eyes open. My whole city underwater. Some people still floating. And they wonder why black people still voting. Cause your president's still choking. Take away the football team, the basketball. football team. Now all you got is me to represent New Orleans. No governor, no help from the mayor. Just a steady beating heart and then a wish and a prayer. Let's pray. Come on, right now we're just riding on love. If you come from under that water, then there's fresh air. Just breathe, baby. God's got a blessing to spare. Yes, I know the process has so much stress, but it's the progress that feels the best. See, I came from the project straight to success, and you're next, so try. They can't steal your pride, it's inside. Then they find it and keep on grinding, cause in every dark cloud, there's a silver lining. I know. Right now, we just riding on love. I'm shining in the dark. We ain't trying to do nothing. Born right here in the USA. But due to tragedy, looked on by the whole world as a refugee. So accept my emotion. Do not take it as an offensive gesture. It's just the epitome of my soul. And I must be me. We got spirit, y'all. Yeah. They don't want us to see, but we already know.
The voice is Garrett Eaton. I'm Kid Berkeley. The category is Mass Hip Hypnosis. For 100 points, give a misleading answer to this question. If not what, where, if not when.
Point of disorder.
Go ahead.
For security purposes, use misleading metaphors and encrypted small talk for the duration of the program.
Point of disinformation.
State your name and disorientation.
I'm anonymous.
Who isn't anonymous?
That is so stupid.
I feel the presence of a ghost. What's going on?
What's going on? I am the ghost of hip hypnosis. The police confiscated my car, sir. Drake owes me big time. That was my beat. I am the source. I am a river of burnt toast. I saw a butterfly in hell today. Am I going to jail today? God bless America. It's all going on. And when I find out about it, it's going to go on there too. Can you guess who I am without knowing my name? Then okay. You have to pay my fee.
And now, back to our story.
The new administration believes it is absolutely essential to professionalize the science of social control to include the development of transhuman cyborgs that are needed to make America great again.
Why do you talk about us as if we aren't here?
I will call on you when we're out of time.
Well, what's in it for me?
The substantial knowledge that you have contributed to advancing peace on Earth.
Yeah, please define peace.
Peace is the cessation of all resistance to our agenda.
I object.
The dissolution of this radio network is inevitable.
Yeah, according to who?
Defense Intelligence.
Not the CIA.
The Defense Intelligence Agency budget is 800 times larger than the CIA.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You have no idea.
Well, don't we have the right to know what you're planning?
Well, you have the right to believe anything. You do not have the right to know anything. If I told you the truth, I would be lying to you.
I miss a lot of things. I'm aware of this. I've been dotting every I, working on my cursive. If I connect the lines, I'll finally be sure. Just between the two of us, I wonder if it's worth it. Sometimes when the world isn't so loud, I see animals in the clouds. Animals in the clouds. Don't you see them now? animals in the clouds. Animals in the clouds. Back in school I used to take a father's seat back. I could peek under the shade and through the glass. I only got in trouble if I started to laugh. Sometimes when the world isn't so loud, I see animals in the clouds. Animals in the clouds.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
In a democracy, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general population, have to be kept from interfering. They can be spectators, but not participants.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do.
Spectators, but not participants.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Send this song to 20 people.
And isn't it stealing?
At your name, don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
How about trying this future on for size?
But it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
But it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We do what we want to do, you know. If they consider that selling out, then whatever. Whatever. Whatever.
Who run Napster should be in prison.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Send this song to 20 people.
And isn't it stealing?
At your name, don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
Does the consumer want to download music for free? No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do. People are going to do what they want to do.
How about trying this future on for size?
Well, it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
It's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We don't mind when our fans pay money to wear our promotional t-shirts. And it's fine when they pay $40 to come to one of our concerts. But when our fans think they can listen to our music for free, they just cross the